I'm Carol Wadeen, and this is going to be the first in three sessions that we have on the historical perspective of Christian art. And today I'm going to be talking about early Christian images. I'm going to start with the catacombs and get close to the 15th century, I hope. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about symbolism in Christian art, and I'll pick it up where I leave off today. And we'll go on up through the 20th century, but I'll be specifically talking more about what the symbols mean in art. I'm not going to take the time to do that today when we cover, or, you know, trying to cover so many hundreds of years today. And then on Saturday, we'll look at how art has been influenced because of the Reformation. But before I begin, because we're going to be seeing a lot of slides this hour, before I begin, I want you to think about something. And Walt, I want you to stop me for sure 7 or 8 minutes before the end of our session so I can get some feedback.
Okay.
I want you to think of how you would picture Mary and maybe Jesus, or how would you illustrate an image of God today? Because you're going to be seeing, as I'm showing you these slides, how art has, how the culture has influenced art. And you're going to be seeing very different images of, for instance, Mary. We're going to go through the Mary cult from about 10th century up until about the 15th century. I think that was when she was really reached her peak. And the saints also at that time. And so we're going to see quite a few changes in how we depict someone like Mary. And how would you see Mary today if she was going to be pictured in this, setting? So that's what I want you to think about as we're going through this. We'll have time to talk about that at the end. Okay, we'll go right ahead and begin then, Walt. And I'm going to show you first just a couple of settings of the catacombs. Have any of you been in the catacombs? Oh, fine, because I haven't, and I'd like to have your response right now. We've been to Italy a number of times, and next time we're sure going to see the catacombs. How was your feeling about the darkness? Just about the...
It was very dark. What surprised me was how small it was. Uh-huh. And each crypt where they had the bodies was very small. Like, I pictured a very small population of people that were entombed in these places. It was very dark.
Mm-hmm.
And the it was almost tunnel-like to walk through. And then the crypts were on along the walls of the tunnel.
And were they dark?
Very dark.
Uh-huh. And dark. And damp?
Not terribly damp, but cellar-like.
Uh-huh. And how were they illuminated today? Did they have some type of bulbs?
There was some, I can't remember, there was some lighting. This has been 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There was some lighting, but it was not bright lights. I think that would probably diminish the effect, actually, if it was too bright.
And ruin what little art we have left.
Right.
Okay.
But that looks like it.
Oh, good. And another illustration of from inside. Now, you can begin to see here, I'm going to be showing you some of the art, like this piece, blowing up in a just a single slide, or over the entryway going into the crypt and so forth. I want you to notice here are the architectural features that are Romanesque and Grecian. You know, the Greek columns, the pyramid area over the columns, very much of a Greek and Roman architecture. Okay, the first one that I'm showing you is Christ illustrated as the Good Shepherd. And notice the clothing. You know, it looks very much like going back to our Grecian-Roman type of clothing. The first few illustrations I'm going to show you will be the blend of the Grecian-Roman deities and the Christian images of Christ. Now the Good Shepherd, when we go back into the pagan stories, there was a Good Shepherd, there was a deity, and he was the deity of philanthropy. And so that was already established. And they're just picking up this image that had been used before then and using it to depict Christ.
What year did you say this was?
This is the around 250. Third century. Okay. Early, middle to early third century. And why don't we talk just a minute about how these paintings are done and why there's some of them are still evident today, because that's many years, of course, for them to be here. This would be wet plaster. It would be done like a fresco. And the plaster would be wet, and the paint would be applied to the plaster. So as the plaster dried, the paint dried right in with the plaster. Otherwise, of course, these would not, there would be no pictures here today if it was just painted on a dry surface. But it was painted on a wet surface, and then as it was dried right into the plaster. But now I understand that they used a lot of candles, or a lot of candles burning and so forth, because this was also a place where they oftentimes held religious ceremonies down within the catacombs. So with just this sort of atmosphere of this burning, the burning candles and the incense and so forth, there's been a great deterioration. And actually time itself would deteriorate greatly.
Is this from an artist's rendition or depiction, or did they draw it from some kind of historical document and try to recreate some accuracy with this?
That's a real good question, and we're going to follow that through, because they didn't begin to look at nature much at all until around the 13th, 14th centuries. They were pretty much going back and looking only as how other artists had drawn. And they copied other artists. And this is going to be a more realistic picture than many we're going to be seeing now, 500-600 years later. Because at this time, the Greeks, you know, they were wonderful artists. And they knew really how to make muscle forms on the legs and how to depict the feet and the hands and all this beautifully. When we get into the Dark Ages, we're going to lose all that.
I heard another question surfacing there in Dan's question. Is this a copy or is this a photograph of the actual wall?
Okay, this is actual. Yeah. This is a photograph of the actual wall. Right? Uh-huh. Okay. Yes. Okay. Yes. And that's probably what you asked, but I took it a little further. Yeah. But aren't those kind of nice looking animals there? Little sheep and whimsical little animals. I'll go rather quickly through these, but please, again, if you have any questions, just ask. Another example of the Good Shepherd. We will see birds quite often, and when we get to one a little later, I'll tell you a little bit about the symbolism. But I think it's interesting here. Notice there's a little foliage. They've got a tree and some birds. And again, we're going to be losing that when we get into what we call, you know, the beginning of the Middle Ages. We aren't going to be seeing nearly as realistic paintings. Oh, here we see the peacock right on the bottom here. I was looking at the Good Shepherd. The peacock will oftentimes seem used, especially with the nativity scenes, and it's symbolic of immortality, because the legend is that the flesh of the peacock never decays. So we're going to see this used again and again. I think one of the last ones I have on the carousel tray today is a beautiful peacock. a pastoral scene, and we'll notice there's even some perspective here and a background with the hills and shading on the hills. It really depicts the side of the hills and so forth, and some wonderful, wonderful animals. Here what we're seeing is Orpheus. And if we go back to our, in legendary Grecian times, he could charm the animals with his music.
Charm the girls too.
Yes, probably. But again, I think the animals are just beautiful. But picking up these pagan legends and the pagan deities and using them as a symbol of Christ. Again, another pagan legend. This is Orant, and they're in, we'll see this person with her arms, and it is a woman in this case, her arms spread out, and it's a sign of prayer. It's also an abstract representation of the soul of the diseased. So you might find it on the crypt where, you know, it's the soul of the diseased, and it's a prayer for that soul. And here we see Orient between the shepherds in a pastoral scene. I want you to notice how the artist has rendered this. He's, you know, notice how the shepherd is managing just to be in sort of a seated position or half seated position to fit the form, because this is the form right here. And the orant standing in the center. To give you an idea what size this is about 27 inches here and about 79 inches from here to here. So you get some idea of what size this fresco is. Now I want to show you a mosaic, and we're only going to see this one, but then we'll see some more frescoes and come back to the mosaics. This is a very early mosaic, but it was used a great deal in the 6th, 7th centuries and on. This one is actually only a 3rd century mosaic, and here it is a, we know that they're depicting Christ, but it's Apollo. You know, the sun god from, again, Grecian Roman times. And also, Apollo was the height of masculine beauty. But we know that it was on a Christian tomb, and basilica. And you can see the little bit of a halo here, and the other Christian motifs in that. And the grapevine. I'll talk more about how the mosaics are formed in just a few minutes when we have a little better examples. This is the earliest example of a mosaic that we have that depicts Christ. Almost all of your major museums that you have in the world will have a few pieces of beautiful Grecian Roman mosaic that was used, like on the floors, you know, back in Grecian times or Roman times. So they had that art down pretty pat. The Eucharist, Last Supper. We're back to our fresco again now. One of the first examples that we have of the Madonna and Child is pretty badly damaged. And then there's a prophet up on the next to the Madonna. But we're going to see now for the next 1500 years the Madonna and the Christ Child again and again and again. But this is the first example we have. 3rd century. Another favorite Bible legend that the artists have used over the years has been the raising of Lazarus. It kind of looks like a fish there in the crypt, doesn't it? But he's, you know, in his wrapped in the burial linens, but Christ raising Lazarus. And I have a few more that I'll show you yet today, and we'll see some more tomorrow. This is another one of Christ going to the tomb now to for the raising of Lazarus. And here we have Jonah being cast out to the sea. You know, they didn't know what a whale looked like in those days. I read the whole book of Jonah this afternoon. I had some help here from one of our other teachers where I find this story. Jonah is a mighty short Bible, or book of the Bible, and so it doesn't take long to read the whole one. But a rather interesting looking whale, and you can see Jonah being spit out of the whale's mouth here. Christ as a teacher, we see here teaching to the apostles. Now we usually will see Christ as either the good shepherd, the teacher, or performing miracles. And that is how it's going to be with the very earliest images of Christ. We don't see the crucifixion much until about the 11th century. We're getting much later in our early images. Again, the Good Shepherd. Now I'm going to be showing you just some beautiful examples of mosaic. They have lasted, of course, much better than the frescoes, just because of the kinds of materials that were used. These are tiny pieces of glass that have been adhered to make the design, and you can see that they can work with very intricate designs and get the shading and so forth of the folds of the fabric and all with it. Beautiful birds, right? And here we see the peacock again. These were 4th century. And most of these have been on floors or walls or even ceilings of basilicas and cathedrals. Here we are with Jonah again. Look at the fun-looking sea creatures here. And this, this is the reason I was asking this morning about what happened to Jonah after he was spit out. Because the Bible story says, you know, he was put up onto the beach. And, well, we can read this almost like a cartoon, because this is the next, the next chapter. And your guess is as good as mine. What's he doing there? Lamenting about going on?
He's giving a tan.
He's giving a tan. You know, the artists do. This is what you call the artist's privilege, I guess.
Well, didn't God cause a bush to grow when Jonah was sitting out waiting for Nineveh to be destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the bush.
Yep. Oh, do you think? Do you think it's Oh, that could be. I hadn't even thought of him getting to Nineveh yet. I was thinking that he's sitting on the beach, but no, he's probably already been to the city and back again.
It's just a thought. I don't know.
Probably complaining to God, they repented.
Yeah. Look at our whale here. Isn't that fun? This little creature. And the colors. Colors are great. Fortunately, you know, the colors here stay and stay, where we lose a lot of our color when we have paintings and watercolor or tempera or oils.
Do the fish have any religious symbolism in this particular painting? I know the fish
and the loaves and all. Yeah. I don't know that is so here.
I don't think so. When they appear singularly, then that's probably a little bit.
Right.
Where there's a school.
Right.
You know, about 500 or 600 years before this, they had beautiful mosaics in many of these Grecian homes and and Grecian temples, and they had wonderful sea scenes. Now we're seeing a mosaic, and this would be up in the asp of a church, and here we're seeing Christ with the apostles before heavenly Jerusalem, and we see the apostles in the background in their very symbolic form. And I'll show you another illustration a bit later where we can see Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John with their animal symbols. But now we're getting a great deal of perspective. You feel the space here, you feel it moving back. And of course, we're looking now at 4th and 5th century. By this time, Christ is on a throne because the emperor of the Roman Emperor has adopted Christianity, and he's sitting on a throne. So he's going to commission art that is going to enhance his position too. And he's the one who's going to, at that point in history, decide who the bishop's going to be. So he is seeing himself in this position too, right, with Christ.
Do we know what the two figures in the back next to the cross are?
Yes. Let's see. I think Luke is the, I've got this, Luke is the lion, and, no, Luke is the ox, and Mark is the lion.
The traditional animal symbols for the four evangelists. They never change. They're always the same.
Right.
Yeah. Matthew doesn't have an animal symbol, does he? Just isn't he?
He's a human.
He's a human with wings. And
humans
then
are animals.
Pardon. Yeah, that's right. And then we have Mark as the winged lion. And this is going to be used on and on. We'll see it again. And Luke is the ox, and John is going to be the eagle. But I want you to notice here the wonderful shading we're getting in the sky with these, you know, little pieces of stone. And the facial features, isn't that great? You know, just remarkable. And I can say, we're going to lose this perspective now. You know, you really feel it, you can look back into that city.
What he has in his hand, is that,
well,
scripture or Bible or Latin? Or?
No, it's Latin. It's the only word I can make out is church. The second word is church.
The first one is Dominus?
Yeah, the Lord of the church preserve consor prudentiator on the, I don't know. I can't do the whole thing.
This is a good example to look at some of the way they depicted this throne with all of the jewels, almost jewels-like, right? Mm-hmm. And the very the feeling of rich fabrics. Because remember the Good Shepherd, that was a pretty lowly image of Christ as far as being a pretty common, ordinary. But now you see, once the emperor has adopted Christianity as his faith, we're going to be seeing a great accumulation of wealth with Christianity. If I'm saying things that you don't agree with, please speak up. We got a pastor here. Do we have any more pastors besides this one woman in the back? Please give me, you know, because I'm just coming at it from the standpoint of an art historian, and I'd like to know your feelings on this as we go through this. But we're going to be seeing a lot of wealth now, oftentimes shown with Christ, with the wealth of the church. The fish here and the loaves of bread.
Yeah,
the
I
miracle
have a comment
of the,
on that.
Pardon?
Very interesting comment.
Okay, please.
That's not original with me. It appears that the very earliest depictions of Eucharists.
Mm-hmm.
Depict both bread and fish Eucharists and bread and wine Eucharists.
Ah.
And that this could very well be, although if it's real late, it probably isn't, but it could be a representation of those bread and fish Eucharists.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is liturgical scholarship and speculation, may or may not be true, but it seems that one likely scenario is that in some parts of the church there was bread and Eucharist, wine Eucharist and bread and fish Eucharist in other places, and gradually the bread and fish Eucharist fell by the wayside and the standardized form of bread and wine came to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's really good.
Yeah, that's a lovely one. And the sandals, aren't they nicely depicted on their feet, and their feet with little toes and all? And here we have the Last Supper, and we do have the fish here, don't we?
There
just
it is. No.
Right ahead.
No. You don't see cups there, do you?
No.
You see bread and fish.
Now, I just wanted you to see how they've arranged how the artist has arranged the Christ and the disciples here. Because if any of you are back on Saturday, when we do the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, and we see how some of the Last Suppers are depicted in the Counter-Reformation, you'll see quite a difference. Here we are with the symbols of the four evangelists. The ox on the top being Luke, and then we see Mark and Matthew, and at the bottom, John. And I go back. Yeah, there's a close-up of Mark then, and another one of Luke. And can you read what that?
According to Luke, secundum Lucam.
Oh, uh-huh.
According to, gospel according to.
To Luke.
Yeah.
Now I want to talk about another medium of art. We've already looked then at two, the fresco and the mosaic. And this is an icon, and it would have been painted on wood. Actually painted on wood, a tempera paint on wood, with a lot of gold on it. And we can see this where they have used probably very finely ground gold to mix in with the paint, or it could even be applied as gold leaf. And this icon does not look as flat as some of them that we're going to be seeing a little bit later. There is more shading, for instance, under her eyes. Notice the makeup even on this one. This is a 6th century icon, and the next one I'm going to be showing you is going to be several hundred years later. This is the oldest example that I have in the library I work with to get my slides. I maybe should say something else about icons here, that they were more than just an image or a picture. They took on some of the presence of the power of the people that they were depicting, the power of Christ. So there was more than just looking at an image here. And again, our pastors may be able to tell or add to that.
No, that's right.
Just really go through these very quickly, because you've seen a lot of mosaics now. Christ dividing the sheep from the goats. And this is a close-up of the kiss of Christ to give you an idea of the medium of using these little small pieces of stone. Judas kissing Christ's cheek. But you can see very closely here the little pieces. Christ telling of the denial of Peter. Item here or art object, and this is an illumination. Now, we won't be seeing illuminations again for several hundred years, at least that I'm going to be showing you today, but I want to illustrate that they were using them as early as the 6th century. This is a manuscript illumination on vellum. That is a parchment that is of calfskin. And these were mostly done in the monasteries by the monks. We see the story of the evangelists, or the gospels below, and then Christ driving out the money changers. The illumination on the top there is Christ driving out the money changers. Illumination is a very ancient form of art that is decorating the manuscripts. This also is an illumination. It's the first one I have that shows of a crucifixion, and this would be late 6th century. But the important part I wanted, or thing I want to bring out here with these illuminations and with the manuscripts, was that it was transportable art. The other art I've shown you this time wasn't able to be transported. And this was a very good vehicle for artists to be able to see what else was being used in other parts of the world, because these would travel. Here we see Zacharias up in the tree as Christ is coming into Jerusalem. Now we're going to skip up to the 9th century, so we've skipped up about 300 years here with the manuscripts. But this is from the Book of Kells, and this was done in Ireland with the Irish monks. And it's very, very beautiful, as you can see. When I was doing some research on the Book of Kells, it said that they must have been angels that were disguised as monks to do this beautiful work. This is the first letter in the Book of Matthew. What does this say to you, if you know Latin? Does this say Christ's name?
No.
Or is it just me?
I don't think so. It's a form of Latin that's... you know, it's a different form of Latin than the classic Latin. I can't read.
It looks like a P, doesn't it?
Looks like a B.
B down there.
Oh, you mean the letter itself, yeah.
The letter itself. It's apparently, in the Book of Kells, it is the first letter for the book. The first letter.
It could be something like preparatio or something, preparation for the beginning.
How about the one before, the slide before? Could you read that any Bruce?
That's where I was trying to. I can make out a lot of the words, but.
That one, girl.
That wasn't the same, it wasn't from the same page as this. But I wanted to point out a few things in this, because I think it's just so beautiful and so wonderful. Now, of course, the Irish monks were very much influenced by the Viking designs, and we see a lot of Viking design here with this intertwining of the foliage and so forth. And I was visiting with Doe about this morning. You know, it would take years and years and almost a lifetime to do a whole Bible sitting in these cold little cells, bent over with poor light, and doing all this beautiful calligraphy work. And I think they just had to have a sense of humor to keep going. And just look at down here, they have put in, if you can see this, this is a cat, and it's trying to catch some mice. And there's one mouse that's gotten back on top of the cat's back. Really, you know, there's just lots of fun things to see as you begin to examine these illustrations closely.
I have seen that in the library there. and
In Trinity, yeah, Dublin?
Yeah, and it's in a little stand, and then it's enclosed in glass, and there's an automatic page turner.
Oh.
And you are allowed, you come through, and you are barely allowed to see one page.
Yes.
And there were two young girls ahead of me, and the guide there said, would you mind moving on, ladies? There are other people on.
We ran into the same thing in Heidelberg.
Yeah, you get very little time, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so beautiful.
Yeah. We don't have any, I work at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, and we don't have any of our manuscripts on show. We have to have, you know, if someone requests to see them, we'll take them in and show them. But we don't have them exposed to the light at all.
This was with an automatic, it turned the pages. But you moved on, too.
And now, notice, let's see, there is a picture, here's a man, there's a figure, and over here there's a, you know, a little family of figures, and here's another one. So they're real interesting, but you oftentimes will find some funny little things, like, you know, one of these foliage pieces will have an animal coming out of it, pulling a tail of another animal, or just kind of fun little things.
So you think it's mostly artistic, as opposed to having some significance?
Oh, they'll put significant things in there too.
Okay.
But
some of just
a lot of symbolism.
Yeah. There'll be a lot of symbolism, but there'll also be these in the little corners, you know, where fun little things. I just put two of these in to remind me to tell you that nuns did this calligraphy work too, and this is done by a nun in Spain, 10th century. And another one by a nun in Spain. And here we see, you know, things aren't so good at this time as far as where you might go if you don't live a pretty good life, because hell looks pretty bad. Another mosaic, and I included this because I wanted you to see the crucifixion. You see the blood actually just coming out in the stream from the side of Christ. Now I've included two illustrations from Illuminations of Hildegard. We're going to be seeing a couple more in Vespers next week because they've asked me to do a Vesper on Saint Hildegard of Bingen. And I did talk about her the other day, just one-shot deal on Hildegard. But I included these because I wanted to point out that we're having a more humanistic thought now of Christianity, and Hildegard believed more in God as being a creator and not a judgmental God, but a very loving and kind God, and we're going to be seeing this influence now in the next few hundred years. Okay. She was ahead of herself in many of her thoughts, because at the time that she was doing her visions and illustrating her visions, this was the type of Madonna and Child that was being seen around that part of Europe. And we see here a very authoritarian Madonna. She's sitting on a throne. There's a crown on her head because she's the Queen of the Heavens. Jesus looks like a little man of wisdom here, but there's not much affection between the two of them, and she is a very stoic woman. Women didn't have a real high place in society at this time. Another icon, and this is from Russia in its early 12th century. And this is tempera painted on lime wood. We're moving up now to the 14th century. And this is a life-size Madonna. It would have been outside of a cathedral. So as the worshipers were coming to the Gothic cathedral, we're up to Gothic times now, as they were coming to the Gothic cathedral, Mary would be welcoming them. And I think you can see quite a difference in This Madonna in Child as to the last one I showed you. This is a far more welcoming one. In fact, she looks like a pretty court lady. And this would have all been painted. It was done in stone, of course, but it would have all been painted with bright colors. The red and blue, the color, red being the color of passion, and blue the color of heaven. And you can see these little holes here. There were stones there, so it would look like precious jewels. And she's dressed literally the way the court ladies of the day were dressed. And looks very much welcoming and kind, humanistic. And there's quite a bit of reality. I mean, you know, lots of us, when we're carrying our little children around, we'll toss our hip out and let the child rest on our hip in this sort of S shape. This is a 14th century triptych. It was done for probably a wealthy family in Florence. We know it was done in Florence. And at that period, Florence was an important city-state. It was the that was the economic city for most of Europe. I mean, it was a very wealthy people there. And it was done for a private worship, you know, as a private altar. These two doors on each side of these two panels were closed, so when it wasn't being used, it could be closed. Of course, we still have the Madonna and the Child here. She's still sitting on her throne with the saints. We also see the crucifixion, the Annunciation, and over here is St. Francis. And we see a beginning of landscape again. Now, we haven't seen that for a long time. Things have been pretty flat. But we're seeing the beginning of landscape now. And it's important, I think, that Donna, the person, the artist of this, included St. Francis in this triptych because it is done very close to where St. Francis was doing much of his work and much of his preaching.
How big is that?
Oh, it's about this size. This happens to be in the museum where I work. It's about this big. And we consider it one of our precious pieces of medieval art.
So they take, I guess you didn't say that, did you, Carol?
Pardon?
Took this and traveled with it.
Yes, this is movable now again. So the last movable piece of art that you saw were the manuscripts. And now this, of course, would be quite movable. And we're also getting painting on wood now. It's not just the sculpture and the mosaics and frescoes. This would all be in gold leaf. We call this room where we have this medieval art in our museum the gold room because, you know, it just radiates all of this gold leaf. But just the beginning of other forms of background. The Byzantine used gold as their background. They didn't have any other form of background. How am I doing on time, Walt? Okay,
you got about 10 minutes.
Oh, well, we'll maybe get all the way up to the 15th century. A close-up of the Madonna. She still looks very Byzantine, but and quite flat. But there's sort of a love, tender relationship between her and the Child here, don't you think? And the Child, you know, is kind of putting the hand up towards his mother. Another painting of St. Francis. This is done by Giotto, a very, very well-known painter in Italy in the 14th century. And you can see St. Francis feeding the birds. The point I want to make here is the movement of Christianity towards a more humane, loving religion. The Last Supper by Da Vinci. And this is the one that most of us recognize. This is a fresco, and it's in pretty bad shape today. They've done, you know, it has gone through several times and they tried to refurbish it. I want you to notice here now the amount of a feeling we're getting of perspective, of moving back into the picture. The architectural elements here lend themselves to this kind of perspective, to have a feeling of moving into depth in the picture. We're moving now up to 15th century in Brussels. I just showed you Leonardo da Vinci's ability of being able to bring perspective into the painting, and we see that now in a landscape of feeling the perspective moving back into the hill line. This is pretty much a perspective done with shading in color by just using, you know, the lighter colors as we get back to have the feeling of atmosphere and depth. The northern artists were really, really looked at nature rather than other forms of art. That little small triptych, they were still looking at images of other artists' work to decide how the saint should look or how Mary and the baby should look. But here they're actually looking at nature. They're looking at real human beings. This is a real human being that was the model for Mary here. And you can see almost every leaf on the trees. Again, we have our peacock. Almost everything in this picture is symbolic, down to the iris, the stag in the background, and so forth. I'll be talking more about that tomorrow. But basically, what I wanted you to see here is the realism and the amount of detail these northern artists were using. For fabric, you know, you almost feel like you can touch it. It's, again, it's another piece that we have in the museum where I work. We just love it. This is a large triptych, and this was done in Flanders. So again, we're looking with these northern artists in their rendition where they show every detail. Now look at the beautiful fabrics here. This is St. Catherine, and look at the jewels on her crown and every bit of beautiful detail. The city in the background here is Bruges, which was a leading city in the 15th century, and much of the wealth of that city was because of the tapestries and because of the weaving done there. And the artists at that time tried to depict the dress of the day. And we can see here the dress, just as the people would be at that time. Mary is no longer in her symbolic clothing of red and blue, but she looks like a nun of the Flemish times. The artists did take a few liberties with the city because the landscaping, this is right on, you know, a coastal city, and so there aren't any hills in the background. This is quite large. This is a triptych done for a church.
Could it be that the guy,
it'd be about the size of the whole screen here. Excuse me.
Could it be that the guy in the red hat is the patron?
Yeah. And I didn't know if I was running out of time. I could spend an hour on this. we think this is Joseph Arimathea, who donated the tomb. Because he's dressed so wealthy, and he was a wealthy man, right? And then we see Mary here, probably Magdalene and Mary Magdalene and John the Evangelist. We don't know who these are. And this is St. Catherine. We can tell that by the attributes that she has, her book and her sword of martyrdom. And this is John the Baptist, and I'm getting into my lecture for tomorrow, but that's fine. Because even though it's got quite nice looking fabric on the outside, inside there's a camel here, and of course he's barefoot. So these are the attributes of these, you know, saints. But we don't know who these are, so we think that possibly they're the people that commissioned the work. And this is a large piece. This is the size of this whole screen, because it's an altarpiece for a church. It was quite common that when they commissioned their work done, they would want their pictures used. But it doesn't seem right. It should be in the center panel. Usually they would have enough discretion to have their pictures, you know, down more on the side or not be quite such a focal point. But we have no other record of who they were in the dress and clothes of the day. Very likely could be. I'm glad you brought that up.
Got about 10 here.
Okay, we'll go through then about 2 minutes, and then I'll hear from all of you how you would picture Jesus and Mary and God today. Isn't that crown beautiful? It just really does look like jewels. I walk by it every day, and I just feel like I can touch her hair, and it would really feel soft. And I don't think you can see it, but if you were in my museum, you could see a tear on Mary's cheek. This is a tapestry that depicts the prodigal son. I wanted to show you as many different mediums as they were using in art forms. This was done about the same time, 15th century. This is a very, very large tapestry. And again, it was used as a way of telling the story to the, you know, the literate people that weren't able to get the story in by reading. This was another medium of telling the story. And it was done, again, in the Flemish area, just where the last triptych that I showed you was commissioned. And then I'm going to quit here, showing a few slides from Notre Dame, because this takes us up then to, this was started in the late 1100s or 12th century. Of course, it took several hundred years to finish, but we're going to see here the sculpture like we saw earlier. Another Mary inside the cathedral, very much like the one I just showed you. So we're seeing a putting together many art forms here. Inside the cathedral is a fresco of the three kings visiting the birthplace, and then ending with this beautiful stained glass, which tells a lot of stories. Right next to, or on the same island as Notre Dame, is Sainte-Chapelle, and this is a beautiful, beautiful illustration of how stained glass was used very, very early on. Okay, so we got through them all, and we still have a few minutes left to hear how you people are going to depict some of our biblical heroes today. How about it?
Well, I would think that if it was Jesus Christ and he was in the same kind of context as he was then, he would be in a kind of a rebel kind of depiction. He would, well, I don't know, maybe Jesus Christ wasn't such a in terms of his appearance, rebel, but I would say in a kind of a maverick kind of mode. When he has his hat on backwards.
I was showing you like towards the end where they were, we could still tell that was Jesus, mm-hmm. but you know, it was kind of hard to tell that was Mary, because yeah. she was, you know, they really wanted to identify the people in the community, wanted to identify themselves with these biblical characters, mm-hmm. and so yeah, I think that would be a...
Yeah, just a general overview, right?
Uh-huh.
I don't think he would be a fashion plate or would be a dress. He'd probably dress very low profile kind of manner. You know? Kind of maverick. Maybe even look something like the homeless or like that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's my thought.
I didn't show you any pictures of God today. We'll be seeing a lot of images of God and the Holy Spirit in the next couple of days. Would anyone want to venture forth with an idea of how you would illustrate God today?
I sort of think like a big vortex of energy.
That's what I would
think. Very abstract then.
Yes.
Just abstract, big energy.
Yeah, vortex of energy.
I think of the wind.
Spirit, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
How about Mary?
Another white teenager.
Yeah. Maybe with a homeless feeling sweatshirt on. And jeans?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweats.
How about the Holy Spirit?
I get the color blue for some reason.
That's Mary's color.
That's Mary's color?
Yeah. Yeah. Historically.
She'd have a blue sweatshirt on.
Yeah. No, Carol, in the whole logo, you called logo of last year?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, are any of those represented in there?
No, that's Lake Chelan.
That's all that is. There's nothing spiritual in that one.
Well, do you people see anything spiritual in there? Anything that relates to any of the images we've talked about? I think it's Lake Chelan with the mountains, done with kind of an American Native motif.
Bruce, tell us, New Age, New
Age. No, it's not New Age, but I see the integration of heaven and earth.
Yeah.
In other words, spirituality has to do with God and the creation all together. Not if you're being spiritual, you're not somewhere off necessarily, but it's integrated.
Yeah.
Heaven and earth.
Mm-hmm. And you have a feel with that symbol very much of the American Native, don't you, design, but also the yin and the yang.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of, could be heaven and earth, that's it.
Sure.
Yeah.
I said that around my daughter, she'd say, Mother, that's Eastern.
Well, Eastern New York.
Well, this is the first time I've made a presentation on religious art as such. I usually go about talking about art from the standpoint of what the artist has done and more about the techniques and so forth. So this has been a lot of fun putting this together.